This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. Coming up, an interview with the artist Ed Smith, who's had several shows at BCB Art in Hudson and at venues around the world, currently showing drawings and sculpture at Concordia College in Bronxville. Ed asked me to make up for what he called a glaring omission in the interview, namely that he neglected to mention Dr. Anne Bertrand Doosnap, who wrote the catalog essay. She is a Hudson resident and a colleague of his at Marist College. After the interview, particularly fine recording of the Bach motet Singet dem Herrn ein neues Lied by the Vocal Consort Berlin. This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and my guest this month is Ed Smith, the sculptor. Thank you for coming. So you've had lots of shows in Hudson, and right now you've got a show going on in Bronxville.
Yes, it's titled Heroes and Villains, and it's down at Concordia College. We're putting together a catalog as well. Yeah, it's quite a large exhibition.
The pieces are also large. The pieces are like life-size figures.
Some of them are life-size, and more than a few are over life-size and over human weight, so that just lifting them up and moving them becomes a logistical feat, a heroic feat in itself.
How long have you been working on these particular pieces?
Well, the ones that are in that exhibition, probably within the last two to five years. I mean, a few had just come back from the foundry. There's one surprise piece, a Laocoon, which had been going on, oh my goodness, since maybe 2006 to 2015. It went out as a Hercules figure, and I was never, when it came back from the foundry, I was never entirely happy with it. So we did something which is not unprecedented, but is rare. We sent it back to the foundry, and I made some big changes and adjustments. Changed the entire nature of the sculpture, cast new pieces, welded them on, and what was a Hercules figure was transformed into a Laocoon. And I'm quite happy with that piece.
And just to refresh everyone's memory about Laocoon.
Well, most people will remember the concept that, or the very famous phrase, I don't trust Greeks even bearing gifts. And that was uttered by the priest Laocoon just before giant snakes came out of the sea and strangled him and his sons for, quite frankly, telling the truth. This happened during the legendary Greek and Trojan War. He was a soothsayer who, as all soothsayers do, as anybody who tells the truth ultimately pays the price.
You use a lot of classical references.
Yes, I don't believe there's anything new. It's all the same, and it just keeps coming around and around, sort of like a helix. So most of the sculptures are titled Laocoon, Heracles, Amazon, things like that, because those myths, those concepts are still present in today's life. I mean, I see people acting in ways that Thucydides and Pericles talked about.
And was this always the case? I mean, did you always use these?
Yes.
These myths?
As a kid, I grew up in Brooklyn, Baltimore, and then moved to Brooklyn, New York. So I'm a Brooklyn boy in two senses. But I was trained by Jesuits, and it was a good education. I had a very good education, but I always felt that I was always semi-literate. So I read and read and read when I wasn't working and working on my sculpture. So it seemed only natural for me to take these literary passages and these heroic and mythological belief systems into the work. And it's always been that way since I was a kid.
And did you start sculpting as a kid?
Yeah, I did. I drew a great deal, but I went to a wonderful school back when high schools could be wonderful, and it wasn't a prison camp.
And this was the Jesuit school.
Yes, they gave me a studio. I mean, I had a studio in high school, my own studio with a door and a key and a lock, and they would give me the key, and I would come in on Saturdays and Sundays, and I would be able to stay there until late at night, and just work in my studio. My studio was maybe three times the size of the studio that we're in right now, and the only thing they really stressed is we don't want you smoking in the building, and so that was very frowned upon because of the possibility of fire. Otherwise, you went in, and I went into my studio and just worked, and we were allowed to choose the classes that we had. So I would have trigonometry, algebra, a couple of courses in Shakespeare, a Latin course, which I was just abysmal at, and translating Latin into Greece, I was probably the worst student. And I would be in the studio drawing and making sculpture.
And then you went on to art school from there?
Yeah, from there I went up to Pratt, and sort of very typical story. You know, you come to Pratt, it's the great school that you always wanted to go to, and you land in New York with like $100, $130, $200 in your pocket, and the first thing you have to do is find a space to live in. And you carry all your stuff in a box. I mean, you know, you ride the dog up, you take Greyhound up, and you land in Brooklyn, and you're just, you know, wide-eyed and full of wonderment. I met my wife the first day of school, and I'm the kind of person I am is I make decisions relatively quickly. And some people have said I'm a man of action. I don't know if that's a criticism or an accolade, but nonetheless, our first date, the first time we met, I told her I loved her and I was going to marry her. It freaked her out, and but we've been together my whole life, so it just seemed natural to me. The life that we lead always seemed natural, and I was incredibly fortunate to study with great artists. I mean, not only at Pratt, I did my graduate work at Columbia University. I was fortunate to study with Kirk Varnadel. I was fortunate to have William Tucker, a great sculptor, as not only my mentor, but my professor, and we're still very close friends. John Walker and Al Blaustein, so just great, wonderful teachers who were the epitome of working artists who you could model yourself after, and you could sort of adopt and modify their stance as an artist. They were exceptional men and women. Phoebe Hellman, just some really great people.
And then how did you end up in Columbia County?
It's probably a good story for the radio. My daughter was born. We were living in Brooklyn. And I was pushing the stroller, as any young daddy would do, so proud of his little girl. And my wife and I were going to our car, so we're pushing the stroller, and my daughter Haley has a little baby doll, a baby Bert, you know, that Bert and Ernie. So she's playing with it, and I'm just sort of pushing her, and we get to the car, and I noticed the baby Bert was gone. And so I said, well, you know, I put everybody in the car, and I said, I'll just go back. It's got to be on the sidewalk. Right? So I ran all the way back looking for this stupid teeny baby doll, and I couldn't find a damn thing. And then it dawned on me, somebody boosted the baby doll. And it was just like, it was an epiphany. And I lost it. You know, I'm running through these tenements, you know, and I'm going, give me the, you know, screaming. And I know somebody in there has this damn baby doll. And if I find out who, you know, and I'm just over the top. It's just apoplectic. And then, you know, I figured I better get out of here. I can understand robbing my car, stealing the car, and stealing the radio, breaking into my apartment to get things which are saleable. I can't understand the value in a pawn shop for a baby Bert doll. So then we left, and we bought a place up here, and we got here 2 weeks before the great October snowstorm. I think it was 72, I think that was.
So you've been here a long time.
Yeah, we've been here Yeah, we've been here when a while. Then when we got here, then it snowed and we couldn't leave the house, so it was great. You know, this is my home.
And did you begin teaching at Marist right away?
No. I've taught probably more places than I have hair on my head, from Bennington College to Boston University to Brandeis University to New York Studio School to Parsons School of Design. Bard College, I taught there for a long time. And after I left Bard, I let the people at Marist know that I was in need of some gainful employment. And so they took me on, and I've been there ever since. It's a wonderful school, and I'll tell you why. We have our president, Dennis Murray, who will be leaving the presidency of the college. He's only been the third president in the college. He's been there for 37, 38 years. And he's really a great man, and he's a man who inspires you to reach for more and to be very entrepreneurial and proactive, and he's an inspiring figure. And when you have somebody you admire, it's very easy to work. He has a concern for every one of the students and the faculty. It's something completely different. He reminds me a great deal of Pericles, or as I imagine Pericles would be, a great statesman, somebody who the value of human dignity means a great deal. And so with President Murray there, it became my home.
How many students?
We have about 5,000, although that's not actually completely right. We have a branch campus in Florence, Italy. We have a number of graduate programs, and we're building buildings. I mean, it's and so we continue to grow, but in an intelligent way. I mean, it's not a sort of ballooning effect. It's a considered, intelligent approach to education. And most people always in education or academia, they have huge problems with senior administrators. And at Marist, that's not the case. These are good men and women who have a great deal of dignity and have a great deal of feeling for what you're doing. And what they want you to do is just go out and do the best job you possibly can. And it's wonderful to be in a position where you're allowed to do that and encouraged to do that. And it's a great place.
What do you teach?
That's a very good question. Right now I'm teaching a capping class, and that's a capstone class where you think of it as a thesis plus, where this is the capstone of their educational history at Marist. I also teach printmaking, a basic printmaking class, which is exceptionally fun. The students work very hard. I mean, you know, they will produce each 100 prints a week. I mean, I'm a tough taskmaster, so they'd learn. And I teach 3D design, which I like a great deal. Most people sort of look down their nose at that, but it's very exciting to introduce people to the sort of the world of three-dimensionality. I teach sculpture, basic and intermediate. I teach drawing, basic, intermediate, and advanced. And I'm sure there's some other things. And I'm also the director of the Marist Venice Biennale program. And during the Biennale in Venice, I take students to Venice, Italy. And they have an intense studio experience alongside the Biennale. You know, and it's a very much an atelier system where I'll be in the same building with them. I have a studio there. They have their own studios. I have my studios. And we have a very close relationship when we're there. And they're there for 4 weeks. Generally, they stay on Italy for a week or two afterwards. So it's a full plate. And I also run the art gallery at Marist and various other things as well.
Do you do most of your own studio work there or in Chatham?
In Chatham. We don't have television. We don't have cable. I stopped watching television when I was in high school. I think it's the stupidest medium I've ever encountered. And I'm not a big moviegoer either. I have a very bad back, so I tend, if I see a movie, I have to sort of walk in the back, and it makes me look like some sort of predator. So I don't go to many movies. The last movie I went to, I think, was a horrible movie. Robin Williams, Popeye, did you see that? It was just horrible. So I don't go out very much.
So you work?
I work. That's my life.
So how long have you been going to Venice?
I go on a regular basis. It's a great city. I mean, most people see it as the most beautiful city in Europe, and it certainly is that, because there's no cars, there's the canals, there's the most gentle and kind people there. But it's really a small town, too. I mean, there's a very small amount of people who actually live in Venice. And once you have been there for a while, they get to know you. So I'll be walking down the street, and people will lean out their window and yell, "Head!" Marist is very generous. They have a great apartment for me, and my studio is in Campo San Lucia. So it's they know what an artist needs, and they know what to give you and what not to give you, and when to speak to you and when not to speak to you, to allow you to have that sort of creative friction and that ferment that you need with the students and your own work. But Venice is a very small city. I go there, and I know the restaurateurs, so you can go in, and you know, while the tourists are all queued up, you just sort of bob and weave, and you're in the back, and you just tell them you want just the regular, you know, and then you get this great plate of octopus or squid. And having grown up on the sea, it's a wonderful cuisine, probably the best cuisine, I think, in Italy. And the people are just the most gracious, the nicest people. I have a great many friends who are there, and they'll invite you into their home, and which is very different than if you're in Rome or in Florence, where I've lived too. But the Venetians, since it's always been a trading city, they have this great history of the sort of the commercial intercourse and the largesse and the freedom that they have with different cultures. So it's a real joy to be there. It's not particularly a sculptural city, so I make regular sojourns up to Florence to check in with the sculptors, but it's probably the nicest city, and it's very much like Brooklyn. It reminds me very much of Brooklyn in its heyday, and when Brooklyn was still Brooklyn, it wasn't sort of gentrified.
Well, I was there once for, I guess, a week or so during the Biennale. Yeah. I know it's a fantastic.
It's great, and if you can stay off the Zattere, where they have the big ships, they come in and out, and they, you know, disgorge all these tourists who stay on that one sort of strip on the Zattere. If you can get out of there and you can get over into Dusadoro or Cannaregio, where the Venetians live, it's a completely different world. And you're not assailed by the tourists. You're not assailed by sort of vendors hawking little tchotchkes and things like that. And if you can stay off of Murano, which is, you know, again, seems to me just a tourist island, that's where they blow all the glass, then you'll get a different experience entirely.
Yeah, I have seen photographs of some of those other neighborhoods, which are just sort of working class.
They're just wonderful. They are. They're working class like Brooklyn. The food is wonderful, and you know, the people are very genuine, and it's and that's where the artists are too. So you'll just be hanging out in a bar, eating, having a glass of wine or a cold beer, and you'll meet everybody And it's reminds me of Fanelli's back in Brooklyn, back in New York. I'm there for a long period, every other year, and generally I go over just to check up on things and make sure everything is good and get some seafood and make, you know, just so I generally, you know, I've been fortunate enough to go once or twice a year, but I'm stationed there every other year during the summer for the Biennale.
You really did land in a cushy spot.
Well, I work hard. I mean, I get up at 4. I'm at the office at 7 o'clock, and I'm there until 10 o'clock at night. And my job, as I see it, is to make sure that everything goes properly, and to really work with students so that, you know, certainly you'll have class time and, you know, you're allotted class time. But I think the best sort of education is the times after class when a student will have a question and you'll get into these wide-ranging conversations. And, you know, it might start about how do you get this thing together? How do you get this sculpture to stand up? And it might end up talking about Behringer in Rhinoceros, in an Ionesco play. And that's where education really flourishes. So I put in my time, and it's easy to work for people who you respect.
Is it a fairly large department?
No, we have a very small department. We're in the School of Communications, which is one of the 5 schools there.
I guess communications is what makes them famous with the polling.
They have that, and they have a number of other things that Marist is quite renowned for. I mean, their women's sports seems to be very good, too. But mostly, I think, what it does is take students who go in, and it lavishes attention and direct understanding on them in a way that used to happen in education.
Now, does the name Marist have anything to do with the Jesuits?
It started with the Marist brothers, but right now we have a huge, while a lot of the students are Catholic, not a lot are practicing Catholic, and there's a large Jewish population there, a large Muslim population, a large Presbyterian. So it's not it still has that concept of service that comes down through the Marist brothers as its overriding principle, but that's really where it comes from.
So let's talk about the show.
Sure.
Have you shown with this gallery before?
I showed there maybe about 12 years ago. I showed a series of reliefs that were based on the events of 9/11. And it was really a pleasure working with them at Concordia. So
these reliefs, what were the
these were
the
these were Tondo reliefs in high fired ceramics. There may have been 1,000 of them in one series, the Seals of Fate. Then there were maybe 1,000 in the other series, which is the Seals of Fortune. And then there were large pieces. There were pieces which were about 2 feet, 2 feet big, to pieces which were 12 inches, to pieces which were 6 inches. Each series that I do, and I mostly tend to work in series because it appears that my best work, or at least what I might consider my best work, it tells stories. I believe in that. There's no irony in what I do. There's nothing like that. I mean, it's a straight, I tell stories about the history of life and man. And so each one of these series, you play it one way, you play it another way, you try it, you know, with some smaller seals, which might be big enough to fit in the size of the palm of your hand, you know, like the Assyrian pieces. So you're always or at least I'm always, you do one thing, you go, what would it look like if it was this big? What would it look like if it was that big? What would it look like if it was, if they were all green? And I can't sort of visualize that in my head, so I have to make it. Every idea that I have has to be physically built. So there's a quite literally tons and tons and tons of work, of which only a fragment gets seen.
Of those these pieces you're talking about, how many were shown at the gallery?
Maybe about 400 during that show. And that, again, that went maybe 10 to 12 years ago. And really, the director at that time was a very good artist named Sadar Arat, a Turkish artist who resides in America. And we developed a friendship from that, and we've kept our friendship with each other. But there were about maybe there were a lot. It was just the installation, and it wasn't an installation as you think. Maybe a sort of an installation artist where people are painting the walls and things are hanging from the ceiling. Now, this was a relatively straightforward exhibition where everything was just literally put on the wall like a painting. It was just floor to ceiling because there was only so much room in the space, and I wanted to be able to tell this long narrative story of the events of 9/11 as I perceive them. And so there was just a volume of work that had to be presented.
So that was the first show.
That was the first show. I guess I didn't tick them off too bad. So they invited me to come back and do this exhibition, which is Heroes and Villains. There's a new director there named Shanley Hanlon, and she did a remarkable job of installing the exhibition. I was really happy with that, because I didn't want to do it myself, and I was much happier having her do it.
And so it's a two-man show.
No, it's two separate shows, actually.
Oh, it is. I see.
So this other guy who's showing in the other, David Marquez, he's the illustrator for Spider-Man, and so he's showing in a separate gallery. And I think Shanley's idea was that David's figures are more villainish, or while Spider-Man might not be as villainish, the people he was reacting against were. And in the gallery that I'm in, it's just my work and drawings and sculptures of heroes.
Do you get involved in the installation?
Generally, because you're a sculptor, you have to. Because when you're, you know, having a 500-pound bronze, I mean, you know, people would go, could you move it 2 inches? And you're, you know, yeah, I can, sure. You know, and where art handlers would take about a week to sort of strategize about it. And you just get in there and lift the goddamn thing and move it. But on this one I did. We just delivered the pieces, and Shanley was very good. She said, would you like to set it up? And I said, no, I'd rather see your vision. I'd rather see your vision of the exhibition, because I found, you know, I've shown a lot, you know, I don't know how many one-person shows, but I know if I go in, I know what I'm going to, I sort of have an idea of what I'm going to do, and then I sort of get what I'm going to do, I get what I know I'm going to get. But if I let the curator, if I just give them completely free rein, I'll see it in a completely new way, and generally it's so beautiful. And in Shanley, in this exhibition, it's just stunning. The installation is absolutely gorgeous. It's stunning. She just did a great job. But what I think that the tragedy of being a person, you have one mind, and you can see it one way. I mean, if you've ever, you know, when I take photographs of sculpture, you know, I'll take some photos, and then I'll get somebody else to take them. And, you know, it's really great because they see it a completely different way, a way I'd never seen it. So, you know, I can get a photographer like David Lee, and he'll come and shoot them. and then I'll give them to like one of I'll give the camera to one of my kids, and I'll go, "Why don't you show me what you see?" And it might be, it's a completely different thing, and it's wonderful because you get a reaction, you get a dialogue going, and it's a dialogue between you, the sculpture, and a third party, as opposed between you and the sculpture only.
Do you work on a sculpture for a long time?
Yes, although, again, since they're series, what I do is I'll have a number of series going on at the same time, so that if I get to a position where I'm at loggerheads with one piece, I don't know how to get this damn arm to do something, I don't know how to finish this or resolve this segue from one thing to another, I can go to another series, which is still going on, and then, you know, work on that, maybe resolve an issue with that, and come back to this other series with a new solution or a new understanding. When I first started making stuff, I used to beat my head against the wall trying to resolve a piece, just standing in front of it, trying everything. The pieces would get so heavy that they would absolutely collapse onto themselves. I mean, it would literally collapse. And it was the most unfruitful way to work. And it seems that one of the best ways to work is if you can, I don't know if you've ever read any Henri Poincaré and stuff like that about notions of space and mathematics and creativity. Not that I have read a lot of it, but he talks about just taking time away from it and letting something settle, and then these epiphanies happening. And I think that's a much better way, personally, for me, to get the best resolution to things.
As far as your style, is that something? Have you worked in this style of for considerable length of time?
I don't even know that I have a style, Richard.
No, you do have a style. It's
I guess other people might see it, but I don't.
But you have a way of sculpting which is individual.
Yeah, I think there I would agree with you. It's like my stuff looks like Ed's stuff. I had a studio in Brooklyn once, and it was a huge space. It was just a huge vacuous space. Afterwards, when I let it go, they rented it to an Alfa Romeo dealer. That's how big this damn space was. And I had filled it. I mean, literally filled it with all these sculptures and everything. And one day I was leaving, I getting ready to lock the door, getting ready to turn the lights out, and I looked and I said, "Holy crap. All these sculptures do the same thing. They shift to one thing." It was like 10 years of work, and I can see this common theme formally in 10 years of work where I hadn't seen it. So I understand what you mean. I sort of just would be... I always like how art historians say things like Michelangelo-esque or Rodin-esque. And I could never see them saying Ed Smith-esque. So I don't know about style.
Well, I would say it's a style that carries a lot of emotional weight.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's... I'm not glib. I'm not the guy you want to... I mean, if you invite me to a party, it's not like having Billy Crystal there. it's sort of like having Goya around. Well, I'd rather go to a party with Goya than Billy Crystal.
Supposedly, according to Ailey Four, when they opened Goya's coffin, they found two skeletons.
I like that. Yeah. There's some people you never get tired of looking at. They're so deep and so, there's so much. And Goya is one. There's just no, you can't exhaust it.
How long is your show up?
This one's up for a while. It's open until April. So they're going to have it, you know, there for quite a bit of time, which is a blessing. because, believe me, if you lift these bronzes up, even with a good hefty bunch of young, you know, bucks, it's still, you know, like, great. Let's keep it here for a while.
Where do you store your work?
I have a number of storage spaces. You sort of have barns, and what I tend to do is work my way out of a space where it's, you fill it up and then you have to build a new barn. You have to build an extension on it. You have to go and rent space. You have, you borrow a barn from a friend and you put things there. You store things. You know, I have all these different caches of sculpture around. Storage is a real issue.
Do you work with the same foundry all the time?
No. I have a foundry out in Oregon, Blue Mountain Fine Art, and they're very good, exceptionally good. The guy I work with out there, his name's Tyler Fouts. He's very, very good. And I also work with a foundry in Oklahoma. So they're best for doing my very smaller bronzes. But there's another foundry that I use over in the Catskill area. That's Esnick Metals. And Esnick Karkashian is just a wonderful foundryman. And he is a genius in terms of being able to get the very small pieces that I make. Because I make big pieces that are, you know, that'll give you a hernia, and small pieces which will fit in your hand. You know, some small silvers and golds and also bronzes. And then I have been very fortunate to work with Vanessa Hoheb, and she's out at Polich Talics, at Dick Polich's foundry out there. So there are four different foundries. Polich Talics, I'd say, is the best foundry probably in the world. Just the world is the best in the world. They do everything, and they invent new processes and new.
And where are they located?
They're located down in a place called Rock Tavern, New York, which is near the Air Force Base down there. And Dick and Vanessa Hoheb, she's just a marvelous, brilliant, brilliant people. They will get you everything you want. And the craftsmen there are outstanding, just truly outstanding. But there's a number of little foundries that are very good to work with, too. And every foundry has got its own thing, too. I mean, if I send three or four pieces out to Oregon, then I can fly out there, and they'll give me the keys to the foundry, and I can go into the wax room at night and during the day and sort of fix things that I, you know, and I can be there. And, you know, when we start patinaing stuff, I can just lose my mind. And then also, when you go to Polich, the craftsmen there are so wonderful, they can get inside your mind. I mean, they're just incredible. So it's a different experience at each one. And then when you start the smaller work, again, it's a different experience. Sculpture is different than painting. I mean, painting, you live in your head, and you're in a room, and you're living in your head. Sculpture, even to move it, requires interaction between people. And sculpture is about that interaction between people. It's about space. It's about that. And while you're working with the artisans at the foundry, it's a real collaborative and wonderful process where if somebody is a true master of what they're doing, they can help you without you realizing it. So when I work with like a master printer, you know, they have the ability to nudge you into the right way. And you get to use two brains as opposed to the tragedy of man. I'm stuck inside my own head. So it's a big deal. I mean, when you can access someone else's mind, and it's a beautiful thing.
You seem to have a pretty full schedule when it comes to shows, right? I mean, it seems like you.
It's um, I'm f- I'm fortunate. You need your work to get out there. You need to have that reaction from people. And it doesn't, you know, and I'm not one of these artists who, you know, it's like, oh, I don't want to do that. That's too little, or that's not worth it, or I'm not going to sell anything there. I mean, you know, Goya's showed his prints in a perfume shop. I mean, there's only 3 sets, I think, bought. You know, you can't base it on that, or that this venue is too small, or it's only going to be seen by students, or it's going to be this or that. What you want to do, and what our job is, in a sense, is to influence things, to make people see a persuasive vision, and to help them understand that. You got to get on the road. You got to get out there and get that work out there. And it's not about the sort of sense of personal self-aggrandizement. It's about the concept that that's what you do. That's part of this thing. I mean, the Ramones used to play, what, how many shows a year? You know, like 300 shows a year. That's what you do. I mean, you go into your studio when you're not inspired. You go into your studio when you have a hacking cough and you're spitting up blood. Or you go in your studio when your best friend is dying. Your dog is going to, you know, you go into your studio and you work. And that's what an artist does. An artist works. You try and get your work out there to be able to encourage and engage in that dialogue with other people. And that's it. That's your life.
Well, I think on that note.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very
much
for coming, Ed.
Thank you, Richard. It's been nice.
Yeah.